Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya.
Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So reading from the Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 9, Chapter 12, text number 7 is on the board. Tasmat prasushutas tasya. Sandis tasyapyamarshana. Mahasvam tatsutas tasmat. Vishva Bahur Ajayata Tasmat from Maru. Does anyone remember who Maru was?
The stuff inside bones?
What was he famous for? What was
Mr.
Yes, that's right. He's not a forgotten person, yeah. Maru. He had mystic powers. And he's going to live for 432,000 years. But don't be jealous. If you want to meet him, you can go to Kalapagrama. He can give you a few tips on longevity. Healthy living. We should appoint him the health minister for ISKCON. Translation. Ramaru was born a son named Prasushuta. From Prasushuta came Sandi. From Sandi came Amarshana. And from Amarshana a son named Mahasvan. From Mahasvan, Vishvabahu took his birth. There will be quite a few verses where they'll be simply names. So probably the most amazing thing about this is that Pariksha Maharaj was listening and he didn't fall asleep. Although he had been fasting for a number of days already. I guess this is like halfway. And he wasn't taking any rest, but still he heard these names and he heard them attentively. I don't know how attentively, but he didn't fall asleep at least, historically. So we should try at least not fall asleep when we read this list of names. I didn't write these, so I take no responsibility for what happens reading these names. From Vishvabahu came a son named Prasenita, Prasenajit. From Prasenajit came Takshaka. From Taksha came Brihadbala, who was killed in the fight by your father. One thing that's good about these names, if you have a lot of disciples in the future, you can turn to this ninth chapter. You'd find a lot of names for people. All these kings in the dynasty of Ikshvaku have passed away. Now please listen as I describe the kings who will be born in the future. From Brihadbala came Brihadrana. The son of Brihadrana will be Urukriya, who will have a son named Vatsavrida. From Vatsavrida will have a son named Prativyoma. And Prativyoma will have a son named Banu, from whom Divaka, a great commander of soldiers, will take birth. Thereafter, from Divaka will come a son named Sahadev. From Sahadev, a great hero named Brihadasva. From Brihadasva will come Banuman. And from Banuman will come Pratikashva. The son of Pratikashva will be Supratika. Thereafter, from Supratika will come Marudeva. From Marudeva, Sunakshatra. From Sunakshatra, Pushkara. And from Pushkara, Antariksha. The son of Antariksha will be Sutapa, and his son will be Amit Rajat. I don't think it was possible that Shukadeva Goswami could have made up these names as he was coming along. From Amit Rajat will come a son named Brihadraja. From Brihadraja will come Barhi. From Barhi will come Kritanjava, Kritanjaya. The son of Kritanjaya will be known as Ranajaya, and from him will come a son named Sanjaya. From Sanjaya will come Sakya. From Shakya will come Shudoda. From Shudoda will come Langala. From Langala will come Prasenajit. From Prasenajit, Shudraka. From Shudraka will come Ranaka. From Ranaka will come Surata. And from Surata will come Sumitra, ending the dynasty. This is a description of the dynasty of Brihadbala, the dynasty of Maharaj Nimi. Srila Shukadeva Goswami said, after beginning sacrifices, Maharaj Nimi, the son of Ikshvaku, requested the great sage Vashistha to take the post of chief priest. At that time, Vashistha replied, "My dear Maharaj Nimi, I have already accepted the same post in the sacrifice begun by Lord Indra. I shall return here after finishing the jaga for Indra. Kindly wait for me until then." Maharaj Nimi remained silent, and Vashistha began to perform the sacrifice for Lord Indra. Maharaj Nimi, being a self-realized soul, considered that this life is flickering. Therefore, instead of waiting for Vashistha, he began performing the sacrifice with other priests. Purport: Chanaka Pandit says, "Shariram shana vidvamsi kalpanta stayi no guna." The duration of one's life in the material world might end at any moment. But if within this life one does something worthy, that qualification is depicted in history eternally. Here is a great personality, Maharaj Nimi, who knew this fact. In the human form of life, one should perform activities in such a way that at the end he goes back home, back to Godhead. This is self-realization. Namo Vishnu Vidaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swami Tanamane Namaste Sarasvatim Deve Gauravani Vricharane Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paskatyade Sadharana. This particular chapter about Maharaj Nimi is more or less consistent with the ninth canto of Srimad Bhagavatam. Prabhupada mentions that Maharaj Nimi was a self-realized soul, and in spite of being a self-realized soul, somehow or another he's going to get into trouble with Vashistha Muni, who's a very powerful sage. Vashistha Muni, I guess he must be some kind of devotee, but obviously he's more involved with sacrifices and fruitive activity, although he's a great Brahmin. So Maharaj Nimi, when Vashistha Muni didn't perform the sacrifice right away for him, he didn't answer him, because if he said, "My dear Vashistha Muni, sorry, I think we'll hire someone else for the sacrifice," he probably would have been cursed right away. So he decided to save his curse for later. In any case, his objective was clear, that he didn't want to waste time. He wanted to perform the sacrifice and get the result right away, because time and tide wait for no man. And in any moment, we could leave our body, and therefore one should do the most essential things first, not wait for the future. Therefore, he decided to hire someone else for the sacrifice. Similarly, we may have many pressing things to do, but an intelligent and thoughtful person thinks, "What should I do right now? What is the most important thing for me to do right now?" And of course, hopefully, that will entail that for us, the sacrifice in the age is to chant Hare Krishna, to be Krishna conscious. In any case, Maharaj Nimi performed the sacrifice, and then Vasishtha Muni came back after some time being on the heavenly planets, and he found out that he wasn't the priest for the sacrifice. Obviously, these sacrifices, there was a lot of gain to be had, especially by the priests, because the sacrifices were generally performed with gold and ghee and all kinds of jewels, and therefore it was not a small sacrifice. It wasn't simply some show, and at the end you get some trophy or something. You actually get something substantial. At least you get the prestige, and what to speak of the pious credit of performing the sacrifice. In any case, Vasishtha Muni comes back, and he sees that it was done without him, and he curses Nimi to leave his body, more or less. Gave up his body. Little heavy, in this canto of Vasishtha Muni, is not seen in the most glorious light. He seems to have a tendency to curse his disciples. So if you take a spiritual master, make sure he's not going to curse you to leave your body or become a Shudra. And if he does, make sure he's not as powerful as Vasishtha Muni, that it actually works. Another part of the ninth canto, there was Prashadra. Prashadra was a Kshatriya in Treta Yuga. His job was taking care of the cows. There was not much technology then. He didn't have, they didn't have electric fences around the cows. And they didn't have automatic rifles or machine guns and anti-tiger traps or anything. So it was quite simple. Of course, we may think, well, this is rather primitive. They were more advanced. Then why didn't they have these things? Because it would have taken a lot of effort to create these things. And it doesn't always work. Therefore, it was quite simple. Even in Treta Yuga, it was very simple. The Kshatriya king, in this case, the prince, Prashadra, would stand there with a sword. And because it was the new moon where there was no moon, there was no light, he would have to guard the cows, make sure the tigers wouldn't come. Unfortunately, a tiger did come. And Prashadra didn't have his night binoculars on. He couldn't see the tiger. He could hear the cows crying out, and therefore he took his sword and swung it. Unfortunately, he missed the tiger, more or less. He cut the tiger's nose and ears, but he cut off the head of a cow, which is not a good idea in Treta Yuga, especially when Vasishtha Muni is your spiritual master. So the next morning, he noticed the cow had his head cut off. And Vasishtha Muni came by and noticed the same thing. So he cursed his disciple that in your next lifetime for killing a cow, you'll become a Shudra. Rather a heavy curse, but it seems like this is not uncommon. Just like Parashuram, he had a disciple, Karna. And Karna was a faithful servant, although he got the job or he got the position being trained by Parasuram under the idea that he was a Brahmin, but actually he wasn't a Brahmin. He thought he was a mixed caste, but actually he was a pure Kshatriya. He didn't even know that his mother was actually Kunti from the sun god. Not a bad parentage. He thought his father was Adirath, who was a charioteer, and a charioteer meant a Brahmin mother and a Kshatriya father. They got the job of a charioteer. In any case, he thought he was a mixed caste, and but he had a great urge to be a Kshatriya, undoubtedly because he was the son of the sun god, who is the topmost Kshatriya in the universe. Therefore, undoubtedly, this desire was manifested by his parentage. He went to Parasaram, but Parasaram had just got done killing 21 generations of Kshatriyas. He didn't like Kshatriyas very much, obviously. So if he would have said, I'm a Kshatriya, he probably wouldn't have got very far with Parasaram. And he had been rejected by his first prospective guru, Dronacharya. Dronacharya seems to have been a little picky in his disciples when, what was his name? Ekalavya wanted to become his disciple. He refused him because he wanted Arjuna to be the best archer. In any case, he went to Parashuram. He lied to him and said he was a Brahmin. But such lying is better than getting your head chopped off by Parashuram, I guess. In any case, he served him faithfully, learned all the mantras, learned all the techniques, and he was such a faithful disciple. When his guru wanted to rest, he let his guru rest on his lap. They didn't have inflatable pillows back there or anything. Everything was utility is the principle. They just used what was available. So his lap was available as a pillow. Unfortunately, Indra, knowing in the future that Karna would be a competitor to his son, Arjuna, he became an insect and started to bore into his leg, into his thigh specifically. Yet Karna didn't want to disturb his guru. So much for consideration, because blood from the insect got onto the face of his guru, and the guru walked up and realized that this person is tolerant. Brahmins are not tolerant, as you probably noticed. As soon as devotees become Brahmins, they become a lot less tolerant. They're very submissive when they take first initiation, and they retain some of that submissiveness until they get second initiation, and then they think, well, I got whatever I wanted, and now my real nature can come out. Therefore, they're generally not so tolerant. In any case, Parasaram realized that his disciple was actually not a Brahmin. He must have been a Kshatriya, because only the Kshatriyas could have tolerated an insect boring into your thigh and not even moving an inch. So then he cursed them that whenever you need your mantra, at that moment it'll be ineffective. Which is better than, anyhow, this is Krishna's arrangement. So, we find that the gurus are not always so tolerant, diplomatic. And here, Prashadra was cursed like that. He's going to become a Shudra in his next lifetime just by doing his duty. He made a little mistake, but somehow or another, his guru cursed him. Instead of appreciating the good he did, he only saw the fault. But Prashadra didn't curse his guru. He simply went into the forest, spent the rest of his life in devotional service, meditating upon Krishna, went back to the spiritual world, and avoided the curse. A lot of cursing in the Bhagavatam. Just like Chitraketu was cursed by Parvati to become a demon. He was the topmost devotee of Sankarshan. He had personally met Anantadev, and yet he was cursed by Parvati to become a demon in his next lifetime. So he didn't lament. He simply went and became a demon. But at the same, he simply bowed down before Parvati, accepted the curse, asked for forgiveness, and became a demon. But that becoming a demon actually resulted in his fighting against Indra and going back to the spiritual world a lot quicker than he would have otherwise. Otherwise than that, he was floating around the universe with a lot of, I guess it was Gandharvis. What's that? But his associates were all the Vidyadharis. Okay. So he was going around the universe in an airplane and visiting all the, well, sightseeing more or less and chanting Hare Krishna. So that could have went on for a long, long time. But fortunately, apparently he'd made a mistake, but actually we can see it was just Krishna wanting him to get back to the spiritual world as quickly as possible. So from our material point of view, things appear one way, because we're a little attached to comfort and protection, and therefore we judge everything according to comfort and protection. If a devotee is put in an uncomfortable situation, like the Pandavas, then we think it's very unfortunate. And when they're put into a comfortable situation, we think it's very fortunate. But they think when they're put into an uncomfortable situation, it heightens their Krishna consciousness, and they're thinking this is very fortunate. It's making us detached from material experience and heightening our Krishna consciousness. And when they're put into a comfortable situation, they become concerned that their Krishna consciousness is going to diminish and their material experience is going to increase. So we've been trained more or less the opposite. So when we read the Bhagavatam, it seems very pitiful. Practically all of Krishna's pastimes are pitiful. Maharaj Parikshit, he was a glorious king just in the middle of his youth. He had tried to protect the kingdom. He was a religious person. And just by making a small mistake of putting a snake on a sage, suddenly he's going to die in 7 days. He's going to be bitten by a snake bird. I mean, we look at our lives and what mistakes we made. What's going to happen to us? If just by putting a snake on someone's shoulder, he's going to die in 7 days, my God, what can we expect? In any case, he didn't lament, thinking, you know, God, you know, this is unfair. Like Yamaraj, when he was a little child, he took one blade of grass and pierced an ant with it, and suddenly he finds himself as Manduka Muni, when he was a little child, he pierced one ant with a blade of grass. And suddenly he finds himself in a position where this king is going to pierce him from the anus up to his mouth with a lance, just by piercing an ant. So then Yamaraj gets cursed from his position as Yamaraj, and he winds up as a Shudra, Vidura. But actually he's quite fortunate, because he gets to associate with Krishna and engage, and he gets a break from simply condemning people. I mean, it must get a little bit boring after a while, you know, looking at people's past and finding out, because only the worst people go to Yamaraj. So to spend your whole, you know, thousands of millions of years simply condemning people to become dogs and hogs, I guess that's the bad cop. So he wanted to become the good cop for a while. In any case, we find in the Bhagavatam also, for Lord Ramachandra, it's a pitiful story. He was a king, and he was somehow or another cursed to go into the forest just when he was just about to be throned. His wife was stolen. Finally, he works hard, he fights against the demons, gets his wife back, and then exiles her into the forest. The whole story is rather pitiful. And there's no happy ending to it either, apparently. Sita enters into the earth, and Lord Ramachandra has to spend the rest of the life of his existence before he goes back to the spiritual world without her. But it's actually not pitiful, we find in the nectar devotion, because it was all ecstasy. It was all transcendental. And therefore, Hanuman every day would read the Ramayana. Not that he was a masochist or a sadist and liked to hear about all the problems his master went through. But actually, it was all the nature of transcendental bliss. Similarly, here in the ninth canto, we get two different ideas. One is, if you think the material world is a nice place, and that things are bad in the material world, because it's Kali Yuga, but if I can wait until the next Yuga, which is coming, Sati Yuga, everything will turn out better. And therefore, just tolerate and stick it out, and things will improve. Or if not, then let me chant Hare Krishna and go to the heavenly planets, and there will be some absuras there, and things will, you know, things will improve. They've been trained. Or let me go to Brahmaloka and let me live there peacefully for 411,030,000,000,000 years and not worry about all this old age, disease, and death for a while. Now the ninth canto is rather discouraging from the material point of view. If we had any attachment left over from the first eight cantos, finding out how difficult the job of the demigods are, how Indra is constantly fighting against the demons, and sometimes he gets defeated, he gets cursed, he gets everything, even to Indra, then we'll find in the ninth canto that the material world's a mess on every place. The heavenly planets, Brahmaloka, everywhere, there is problems. And therefore, when the tenth canto is introduced, again, there's problems. Even Krishna, from the beginning of his life, he has problems. Beginning of his life, they were trying to kill him. Even God takes birth. He has reason to be paranoid. A nurse comes to feed him milk. She tries to kill him. His mother puts him underneath the cart. The cart's trying to kill him. The wind's trying to get him. The animals in the forest are trying to get him. Everyone's trying. He's after him. And then his life is, well, it appears to some people that it's a miserable life. He has to eat. He has to go to his neighbors and try and steal. I mean, it appears like that. He gets all the girls in the village excited and then has to flee because they're all after him. He goes to the next city and he winds up having to maintain 16,108 palaces. And at the end, so many things are happening. All these warriors are trying to kill him. They come from all over the earth planet to kill him. He's like a magnet for trouble. And finally, at the end, all his relatives, they all get drunk and kill each other. So what a life. But it's all to show, but this is Krishna, this is the sonam bonum of the Srimad Bhagavatam. This is the goal that everyone's looking for. But we should understand that it's all Krishna's pastimes. It's for Krishna, it's all pleasurable. There's no idea that anyone's really dying. Everyone is actually simply changing their body, and by associating with Krishna, they're getting a higher existence. But this we won't find so much in these pastimes of Nimi and Vashista. Although they're great personalities, we'll find that they're cursing each other, leaving their bodies, and going through so many different problems, but the result is not necessarily they're becoming Krishna conscious. But in the 10th canto, because it's manifested in this material world, therefore there are so many problems. It would be a little bit utopian to think, oh, Krishna comes, as it's described in Krishna's appearance, and all the rivers are flowing, and the clouds are nicely making their sounds, and everyone is peaceful, and the birds are, peacocks are dancing, everything's dancing. That's when all the problems begin. Because we're in the material, Krishna is manifesting his problems in the material world, and therefore it would be rather naive to think that nothing bad would happen during Krishna's appearance. No, as soon as, because the material world is made in such a way, as soon as one becomes actually a devotee, then people, then the demons, naturally they try to attack you. Because that's their business. When the Hare Krishna movement has no problems, it means that we're more or less not doing our work. Because if we were actually doing our work, the demons would get disturbed. But as we can see, the demons actually like us. Therefore, it means that we're probably not doing our work as much as we should be doing. Because demon means, just like in Kamsa, Kamsa, after Durga appeared before him, he was trying to dash little Durga on the prison steps, and Durga flew out of his hands and manifested herself as Durga. And Kamsa, he was a devotee of Durga, more or less. So he thought that this Devaki and Vasudev, I thought they were devotees, they were going to manifest some, you know, like God or someone, but actually they manifested Durga, my worshipful deity, therefore they're really special. And therefore he released them, prayed to them, asked for forgiveness, said he wasn't the doer anyhow, you know, we're just instruments for God knows who. But as soon as he left them, immediately he got into the association of his friends, the demons. And they twisted everything in such a way as their conclusion of his episode was, let's go to Vrindavan and torture everyone there. Kill all the cows, torture the Brahmins. Let's get into it. We're inspired now after your story. And Kamsa, because he was the greatest of the demons, he also got inspired. Yeah, that sounds like a good idea. Let's go there and kill all the cows, torture the Brahmins. Let's do something significant. But at least there were Brahmins to torture. At least the demons had some reason to do something. They had some goal. Nowadays, they're just bored because there's more or less everyone's like them. They have to attack all the other demons. But if they're actually devotees spreading Krishna consciousness, then the demons will actually have something to do, something significant to do. In any case, the material world is made in such a way that there's always going to be problems. And the problems are not bad because they awaken us to our real problems, old age, disease, and death, which are the steady problems that no one, either in the most peaceful place in the material world like Brahmaloka, or in the most hellish planet, everyone is under the realm of time. And therefore everyone has the greatest problems, the fact that they're going to have to leave their body and face old age, disease, and death in the meantime, and take birth again. So if there are some problems, they're simply meant to awaken us to the fact that the material world is a place of problems. Dukkhaliyam ashasvatam. And when there are no problems, and we become complacent, and we think we're doing all right because there's no problems, I must have done something pious, then that's the real problem. Because at any moment, death can take us away, and if we don't make progress, then we have to come back and face problems again and again and again. In any case, so we should understand that although the ninth canto seems that, well, there are so many names here and so many problems, let's get into the tenth canto. Why would we have to hear about all these problems? We have enough problems ourselves. Why do we have to hear about their problems? No, it's to remind us that we have to expect problems, but we shouldn't be disappointed if we try to become Krishna conscious in the midst of these problems. As Queen Kunti said, Vipadak Shandu Takshasvat, Tatra Tatra Jagat Guru, Bhavatadyat Napanaryasya, Apana Bhavadarshana. That I wish that we can see these problems again and again, so we can see you again and again, so there will be no more seeing a repeated birth and death. And then she says, Janma Aishvarya Shudra Shivira Edamanak Manak Puman Naivahat Yavudatum Vai Twamakinshana Gochara. That anyone who's striving for higher birth, material opulence, anyone who wants great material beauty, anyone who wants great material learning, and thinks that these are the goal of life, when they attain them, then they'll become puffed up, they'll become complacent, they'll become proud, and they won't be able to chant Hare Krishna with some feeling. Therefore, she was saying that these things are not positive, although for most people in the material world, they are positive. On the other hand, if we do have those opulences, we shouldn't be proud of them, but we should utilize them in Krishna's service, knowing them that they are actually Krishna's opulence. They're not belonging to us, they're actually belonging to Krishna, and they're meant for Krishna's service. But if we want to enjoy them, thinking that now I have some opulence, and therefore let me enjoy it because I worked so hard to get it, then it'll simply, in the future, will use up our pious activity, and we'll have to face the impious reactions. Like Maharaj King Nariga, he had acquired unlimited pious activities, but he wound up being a lizard in the bottom of a well for a long time. So he worked hard to get happiness, material happiness, and he wound up as a lizard in a well without any water in it. So that's quite a struggle. Nothing to eat, nothing to drink, and simply sitting there. But fortunately, because he was a devotee, he thought of Krishna, and therefore he was saved by Krishna directly. But if we become a lizard in the bottom of a well, we may not be so fortunate. Therefore, rather than try to take shelter of our pious activities and hope for the best in the future, or lament about our reactions where we're experiencing the present, we should simply go on with our Krishna consciousness and try to make the best use of our situation. So, I'll stop there. Thank you. Any questions, comments? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, you were mentioning that when Krishna manifests his pastimes in the material world, that there's always dangers. But what happens in the spiritual world where there are no demons, there's just all devotees?
Well, there are demons there, but they're devotees.
In the spiritual world? Okay.
Yeah, there's demons. Going to Brihad Bhagavatamrita, there's Kali, a serpent there. There is Aristasura. There's Keshi demon, but they're all devotees. So when Kali appears, then Krishna dances on Kaliya's hoods with the gopis in the rasa dance. Keshi demon, he rides around, he takes Krishna around Vrindavan. Similarly, Kaliya, when Kaliya appears, Krishna takes the tops of the Kaliya Nagis, of the Nagis, what's the name? The
Nagnapatis.
He takes their tops and he threads Kaliya's noses with it and rides Kali around the Jamuna. So there's rather interesting pastimes. So there's no real demons, but there are rumors of demons in the spiritual world. And therefore, sometimes we find that the residents of Vrindavan, they try to protect Krishna from the supposed demons that may be coming. There has to be some mood like that. Not that, oh, it's all so nice and everything is, you know, little struggle, even the mentally is good. Yeah.
Also, my next question is that in the Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Prabhupada mentions in one verse and purport that sometimes the devotees in the Krishna conscious movement may take birth on the planet where Krishna is displaying his pastimes in the womb of gopis to become trained in their relationship with the Lord. So is that always what happens? Does anyone ever go directly back to the spiritual world without having to stop at that planet? Of course, Krishna's plan is perfect, but...
You don't like that idea.
I like all of it. I'm trying to understand how it works.
Well, because here, say we became perfect, and perfect means that we become Krishna consciousness, we're always thinking about Krishna. Even Krishna comes before us, and we're thinking about Krishna's pastimes. But it's not that we go back to the spiritual world and that we know exactly what to do. We have to get trained up before we go back to the spiritual world. Otherwise, it would be a little embarrassing. We got back there, and someone says, you know, make Krishna some betel nuts. And we say, well, what is a betel nut? Well, you kind of be a useless gopi there. I mean, so therefore we have to get some training before we get back there. So we wind up in some place where there is like a seminar on how to become a gopi. Otherwise, you find out there's, you know, 50,000 new gopis in Goloka Vrindavan. No one knows, they don't know anything what to do. It would kind of spoil the pastimes there. But in Gokul, it's acceptable because it's in the material world and you expect a few mistakes here and there in the material world.
I have one more question.
Yes.
I wanted to ask about dying. That in the Bhagavatam, there's so many different examples of how people die. Like Dhruva Maharaj, because he's so exalted, he could see death coming, and he could also see the Vaikuntha plane. So he stepped on the head of death and got onto the plane. And then there's other stories, like the story of the Brahmin who was meditating on making the sweet rice for the Lord, and he was so absorbed in the past in serving the Lord that the Lord in Vaikuntha was so pleased and smiled and sent a Vaikuntha plane. So he didn't die, he just boarded the plane. And then, of course, you know, Srila Prabhupada saying that generally at the time of death, the voice is all choked up, it's very painful, it's very awful. And then I heard one last description where Srila Prabhupada saying that for a devotee, death is just like going to sleep and waking up and with Krishna. So,
yeah, we should become a devotee. The body may go through so many different things. But the question is what we're going to do. Therefore, we're practicing in the midst of disturbance how to remain Krishna conscious. So in the midst of the greatest disturbance, we'll still remain Krishna conscious, and then we can go back just like that, just like going to sleep and waking up. But if we get disturbed when our body's disturbed, then it's not going to happen like that. We're going to have to come back and practice a little bit more. In any case, the worst thing is, when you just mentioned the stories, is Tukaram's wife. Tukaram. When the airplane came to take them back to the spiritual world, Tukaram went to call his wife and said, come with us, the Vaikuntha airplane has come to take us back to the spiritual world. And Tukaram's wife said, I can't go because I have too many household things to do. I have to clean the house, you know, you go.
She was making chapatis.
Is that what she was doing? I hope they puffed up. I hope at least they puffed up.
She thought he was going on a tour. She said, okay, come back as soon as you're ready.
Well, that's a nice version of the story. Okay. In any case, he left on the Vaikuntha airplane and she ate the chapatis. Yes.
You were mentioning curses in this in your presentation, and I guess as devotees we are taught to avoid offenses to the holy names, and
you guess you're not quite sure.
I guess, yeah, I mean, we are expected not to chant with offenses, and the curses seem to be almost self inflicted. By the offensive chanting, you're almost cursing yourself when you are chanting with offenses, and it seems like a chicken and egg problem, because you're never going to get out of it if you're constantly cursing yourself by this offensive chanting.
In what way are you cursing yourself?
Because though in the ninth canto there's a story of Sukanya, and There's one verse where it states that by the will of providence, how do you pronounce that? Providence. She poked Javana Muni with something pointed, and it seems that what you're carrying.
To be a little bit more fair to her, she saw some glowworm in the hole. Not that she met the stage and stage and started to poke him with something.
when speak for myself, when I'm chanting, it's not that I'm wanting to create offenses. It's not.
Well,
that
our,
I'm wanting
our,
to do
our
this.
Main problem is, we identify ourselves with our mind, and therefore we become attached to the ideas in the mind by identification. They're not actually our thoughts, but because we become attached to them, we make them our thoughts. Therefore, it just prevents us from actually hearing the holy name, because we become absorbed in something else. But if we just don't accept it as being me, and just let it go by, and just pay attention to chanting better, and listening better, then eventually we'll make some progress. But if we become attached to our emotional state of mind and our thoughts, then of course we don't make any progress because we don't try to. We actually think it's us.
But at the same time, the mind is very difficult to overcome.
Yeah, well, we shouldn't glorify it so much. I don't want to overcome you. I have to respect your difficulty. Therefore, I don't want to discourage you. So therefore, I surrender to my mind because I don't want the reputation of the mind that someone could actually overcome you. Now, Krishna says, yes, Krishna says it's difficult to overcome, but if we take shelter of him, he said, one can easily cross beyond it. So rather than glorify Maya for how difficult she is to overcome, we should glorify Krishna for how simple he makes it to overcome Maya if we take shelter of him. That's a better glorification. So it's like if you run up to a tree and grab hold of the tree and say, let me go, let me go, let me go. But the tree's not holding on to you, you're holding on to the tree. So don't blame the tree. Just let go of the tree and then there's no problem. So Maya is simply presenting us different illusions, but we don't have to be attached to them, but because we want to become attached to them, therefore it appears very difficult. But Maya is not holding on to us, we're holding on to Maya. Actually, the soul is beyond Maya, as Krishna says. Nadi vam nirgunadvat paramatmayam avyam sharira sopikuntiya nakaroti nanalibyate. Those who can see with the eyes of eternity can see that the soul is transcendental, eternal and beyond the modes of material nature. Despite contact with the material body or Arjuna, the soul is neither doing anything nor is he entangled. So we're all actually transcendental to all this. But because we like the drama, and we think we're actually the hero in some, or the heroine in some drama, we don't want to give up our part. We're attached to this role. But if we just give up this part and accept the fact that we're Krishna's servants, at least agree to utilize this present role in Krishna's service, then there won't be any problem for us. But as long as we want to enjoy this role, I'm this and I'm that, I'm queen for the day, I'm king for the day, whatever, then of course there's going to be problems for us. But the problems are trying to encourage us to get out of this false conception. Yes.
So if it's false, the high majority of people feel that this is true, this is reality.
Because it's a democracy.
At some point, when civilization is started, everybody should be pure, and then it should start kind of getting people to dilute it. But nowadays, if you look at the society, we see
that most of the people feel that all this untruth is truth, and truth is somehow or other very much covered. And to get to that truth, everybody has to work very hard. Either it's discharging the devotional service or being engaged in some sort of other practices that bring us to the point where we understand that, it's Chetudarpanam Marjanam.
So why is it so difficult for everybody?
What's that?
Why it's so difficult for everybody to understand?
Because people, they like Kali Yuga. They're attached to it. They don't want to give it up. On one side is like that. The other side is the devotees aren't preaching strong enough because we're a little attached too. And because we're not preaching enough, therefore people are not understanding so clearly. So there's many ideas. I mean, Kali Yuga is meant to give, on one side, the living entity a chance to fully experience sinful activities. And the association of other people are encouraging it. It gives a full taste of sinful life. Because people in the other ages, they may feel restricted by morality or God or whatever. But obviously everyone's come to the material world because we want to become God. So Kali Yuga gives us the greatest opportunity to imagine ourselves become God. To do whatever we want to do, whatever our senses and mind dictate to us. So this is part of the experience of material existence. It's not that in Satya Yuga, where people are actually more Krishna conscious than we are, it's not that all of them went back to Godhead either. But by some attachment, they decide to remain in the material world, maybe elevated to the position of a demigod, and experience that taste. So there's different types of varieties of tastes and experience, and Kali Yuga is one of them. I mean, just like not everyone goes to see, you know, Twinkle Bell and what a Cinderella at the movies. Some people go and see Dracula. They're attached to seeing that. They love horror movies. So those who love horror movies, Kali Yuga is a great experience. And it gets better as time goes on. Yes.
Maharaj, you were saying that one has to become purified to know how to serve the Lord.
Yes.
So what happens in the instance, like for one example, is Pondraka. Like Pondraka really hated Krishna and he insulted him and imitated him. And in the very end, when Krishna killed him, he sent him to Vaikuntha with a forearm form. So doesn't the subtle body go with the person? And what did he do when he got there and he was surrounded by devotees when he used to hate Krishna and now he's got a body like Krishna? For real?
I don't know.
And also,
you have to go there and ask him.
But also with Mother Yashoda,
Putana.
Putana, how she would became Krishna's mother.
It doesn't say exactly what the interim steps were before they got to Vaikuntha. Or we only get the final result.
Okay, so there's some training along the way?
Yeah, obviously they have
reprogramming?
Yeah, when we find out that after leaving this body you go to some universe where Krishna has his pastimes and get trained there, so we can understand that generally there's some training going on.
Even for the demons. I thought it was an immediate transfer.
You mean the demons get some special compensation?
Well, in the Krishna book, in the story of Pondraka, it seemed like it was an immediate transfer, that Krishna killed him and then he took a form feature and was in Vaikuntha. Right away.
I don't know. That may be true, but I don't remember. In the Krishna book, at least, it doesn't say he took four hands. It said he went back to Vaikuntha.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know about taking. He already had four hands, but he lost his head. Exactly what the situation is. Well, all we know is that, generally speaking, at least in the case of the residents of Vrindavan, that there's a certain training period, which doesn't seem unreasonable.
Right, exactly.
So whether or not there is, you know, someone gets to Vaikuntha, I mean, even Gopa Kumara took a long time to get to Vaikuntha. It wasn't that he just kind of like manifested himself there. He had to have some training at every step. So generally speaking, to get any position, you need some training. Even when we find Ajamil, he got the association of the Vaikuntha Vasis, and he saw the Yamadutas, but he didn't go back to Vaikuntha right away. Although he chanted without offense, he had to be trained in devotional service before he became eligible. So sometimes it finds, I mean, just like this Brahmin, at least in Vaikuntha we find, he was meditating and he and service in that particular rasa, so that seemed like it was sufficient to bring him right back to the spiritual world. Because there, you, the level of, you know, the meditation of service is sufficient. But apparently in Goloka Vrindavan, where the rasas are a little bit more sophisticated, then apparently you have to get trained up in the different mellows before you can go back to Goloka, at least. Yeah.
And it's also possible that, like us in the material world, Krishna, say, oh, go to the material world and be an illusion for millions of lifetimes, millions of universes. A lot of the demons Krishna killed, Krishna asked them to go to the material world and pretend. So they might have returned back to where they're from. Whereas we, being conditioned souls for millions of lifetimes, we have to go to another universe and get retrained, then go back. That's a possibility also. Yeah, am I right, sir?
Maybe. I don't know if... Didn't mention that Putana was, you know... Generally, at least in the third canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam, it mentions that there was a planet of sorcerers. And that Kamsa, he went all over the universe conquering these demons in the universe and got them as part of his entourage. But it doesn't mention that they specifically came from Goloka Vrindavan. Only in the case of Jayan Vijay does it really mention that. And even in that case, Prabhupada mentions in the Chaitanya Charitamrita that not in every millennium are Hiranyakashipu and Hiranyaksha are they actually gatekeepers or devotees. Only in some millenniums they're actually demons. Okay, thank you very much. Grantaraj Shimad Bhagavatam Ki Jai. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Kaur Premanande. Ki Jai.